Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Susan Schneider. She is the NASA Baruch Bloomberg Chair at the Library of Congress and the director of the AI Mind and Society Group at the University of Connecticut. And we're talking about her new book, Artificial You, AI and the Future of Your Mind. Dr. Schneider, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I read this book, and there is so much that we could talk about in this book, and I'm just warning the audience on my behalf, we're barely going to get through some of my questions about this, because there's a lot to discuss. But one of the important things I want to mention is it's important that people be discussing the issues that you bring up in your book, and talk about that for a second.
Sure. So I'm so excited to be here talking about the book, and there's so much going on in the world when it comes to artificial intelligence right now that it's sort of mind-blowing. So, you know, AI is all around us. It's there when we're doing a Google search. It's there beating the world Go and Jeopardy champions, and it's getting smarter by the minute. So what I talk about is the future of the mind, and I'm interested in questions about whether the robots around us would be sentient, whether it would feel like anything to be them, and what we could do to enhance the human mind itself.
One of the things you talk about is that there's probably going to be a major technological singularity when we sort of improve quantum computing, that we're already starting to do quantum computing, but once we really sort of master it, if that's the term, there's going to be a major change in the way that we deal with robots and with machines.
It could be the case. So, you know, there's already talk of Google achieving quantum supremacy, and it means less than you think. So right now we don't have the sophisticated software or even the quantum capacity to do much with the quantum computing that we have. And it could be in 20 years, you know, that quantum computing does make a monumental shift in the future of computation. I think from a cybersecurity standpoint, there are already challenges we're seeing today.
Okay.
And but it's not altogether clear what that means for the future of creating human-like AI or AI's capacity to go in the head. We're not even clear on what the role is of quantum mechanics in the brain itself, whether that is the chancy nature of things at the quantum level actually filters up and affects human thought.
One of the things about quantum computing, though, is it means that the computing is going to become incredibly fast and complicated, and that the machines that are going to do the computing can get very, very small. So you combine that with sort of robotics, and it's easy to imagine that people are going to start to be thinking that we're going to be building androids that are conscious. And one of the first things your book does is try to define what human consciousness is. That seems to be still an open-ended question, that everybody has an idea, but there's nothing really proven yet.
For sure. And yeah, I mean, we can't really tell that the use of quantum computers will enhance the prospects for creating conscious AI, by the way. But let me say what consciousness is, as you suggest.
Are you going to give me a definition of consciousness?
Somewhat. I'm going to assert it in a way. Here's why. Philosophers will argue for hours about how precisely to define consciousness.
Right.
But I think there's one way I can quickly get the issue across to your listeners. So consider what it feels like to be you from the inside. So every moment of your waking life, and even when you're dreaming, mm-hmm. there's a felt quality to your experience. So when you're,
it's the me. It's the thing that I feel like is me.
That's right. And so when you smell the scent of a rose, or you hear the sound of jazz, or you have the pain of stubbing your toe, in all those cases, it feels like something from the inside to be having these experiences, and no one can understand precisely what it's like to be you in that sense. No one can, like, get inside of your head. Well, that's what it is to be conscious. And consciousness is a massive mystery right now. And we don't understand why we're conscious. So, you know, to go back to the quantum thing, which, you know, isn't really an issue I spent a whole lot of time on in my book, it's just not at all clear that there's something special about quantum mechanics, as some claim, that answers questions about consciousness.
Well,
right?
Wait a minute.
Like that, right?
But there are people who are saying that if we build a sufficiently complex computer, that consciousness will just happen.
For sure. Yeah. And I call that techno-optimism. And I argue against techno-optimism for some reasons that I think I can mentioned super quickly. Okay, consider how your own brain works. Believe it or not, most of the computations in your brain are not even accessible to consciousness.
That's right.
So, for example, try to introspect how your auditory system works or how your visual system works. You can't. That's why we have cognitive science. That's why people have to run all kinds of experiments and look at defects in the brain. So the upshot of that is there's all kinds of sophisticated computation going on, even in your head, that isn't conscious. So when we think about the future of computation, I don't really think it's clear at all that machines will need to be conscious to have very sophisticated intellectual abilities. In fact, I think they might even be able to outpace us in a variety of ways. We're already seeing that now, in fact. You know, it could be that we even hit the holy grail of artificial intelligence, which is often considered to be general intelligence, or what some people like to call AGI, artificial intelligence. It even acts like us, and it can do all sorts of tasks the way that we do it, but it may not be conscious.
So it'll be a zombie, in other words.
Yeah, what philosophers like to call a zombie. So, philosophers thought experiments.
But no, I get that. But one of the challenges, too, is I know I'm conscious because I can experience it. But when you push comes to shove, I can't even be sure that you're conscious. I can't be sure. As a matter of fact, we're talking on a phone right now. And I've had conversations with chatbots that are incredibly sophisticated.
That's so awful, isn't it? I hate it when I get spoofed by one of them.
And you start, but you could
be like talking. It's only going to get worse. And I could.
So wait a minute. I can't even be sure that you're not a zombie. You're not you're not a machine that's mimicking what a conscious mind is.
Hey, maybe I'm a chatbot. A really good one.
You're a good one.
on a more serious note. Okay, so
what well, my problem is, I guess what I'm getting at is, do we even have a way to test a machine to see if it is conscious?
Yes, I suggest a few tests in the book, and I'll talk about those. But let me first mention something to respond to your very, very good observation, a very important observation, that because no one can get in the head of anyone else, in the human case even, we don't really know definitively that the people around us are conscious. And let me tell you what philosophers say. They say, well, yes, this is yet another form of skepticism, and it's an important question to consider. In fact, if you take a course in epistemology or theory of knowledge, you'll consider it. But what we usually do to respond to those cases is we point out, well, we can infer that the people around us are conscious because it feels like something to be us from the inside, and they have similar nervous systems and they behave in similar ways. So we sort of think that it's highly likely, and it would be really bizarre if they weren't.
But you're still making a leap of faith.
You're making a leap of faith that, in a way, what you're doing is you're saying the best explanation for the behavior I see in individuals is to conclude that they're conscious. And I think that's a little bit more sophisticated than a mere leap of faith. I think there's some sort of grounds to make the judgment. But now the next issue becomes, could we do that with AIs? And in the book, I suggest, no, we can't.
It could be a different the thing that we're not even used to. Like, for instance, I've interviewed several people who are trying to figure out whether other species of animals are conscious, or is their conscious minds as complicated as ours, or is it on a sliding scale or whatever. And it is problematic. I mean, it is, you know, there's that test I'm trying to think of the movie Blade Runner, where he's trying to ask whether the guy's an android. He gives them these problem solving, but we have no way of testing whether a machine is conscious or not.
Well,
and it could be a different kind of consciousness.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the test in Blade Runner, because in a lot of ways, one of the tests that I suggest,
I know that,
which I wrote jointly with Edwin Turner, you're setting me up. Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, a test I did with the wonderful astrophysicist Edwin Turner, a great collaborator, was based on the Blade Runner test in a lot of ways. So basically, consider that scene where Deckard is checking to see if Rachel, the android, mm-hmm. is truly an artificial intelligence. And what he does is he probes the quality of her mental life and sees her emotional reactions. Well, in a similar vein, Turner and I suggest that in certain contexts, like at the R&D stage, before you bake in, you know, stock answers,
okay.
you know, while you're still testing the capacities of the system, you could give it clever questions designed to see if it has the felt quality of conscious experience. So in the human case, notice that we can all talk about consciousness. In fact, we like to speculate. So, you know, if you've ever thought about the possibility of reincarnation, or the mind surviving the death of the brain,
right.
or the film Freaky Friday, where the mother and daughter switch bodies. So we have this idea that all this stuff is conceivable, even if we don't think it's real, or maybe
right.
some of us do think it's real. And the reason that we're able to conceive of these cases is because we're conscious minds. So it feels like something to be us. And so what we do is we give scenarios to the AI to see if it similarly feels like something to be them. Okay, but you can't give this kind of test to all sorts of AIs. I mean, for one thing, you could have a conscious AI in principle that's not linguistic.
That's okay? right. That's right. Exactly right.
So you have to be really careful, and you also can't give it to
Well, that's like an animal is the same way, is that we can't, how can we test
yeah,
most animals? Because they're not linguistic. Right. But, well,
yeah,
you're saying that,
yeah.
but we don't have proof of that. But we assume that based on different tests and behaviors.
For sure. So, you know, there are clearly going to need to be a variety of ways to test machine consciousness. And that's what I suggest in the book.
Right.
And I suggest another test as well. So yes, this test is called the ACT test, the one that I just mentioned.
That's right.
And it's merely meant to be a sufficient condition for a machine being conscious. So in other words, if you pass the test, you should be in that category of beings that we consider to be conscious. And we believe that it would deserve special moral consideration on that basis. But if a machine fails the test, say because it's not a linguistic machine, in that case, you shouldn't have even run the test on it. Or if it fails it because it's so alien, it's so different in its ways of conceiving the world than us, still, that means that we still have to open our minds and think that it could be conscious according to other tests. So that's why it's important that we run as many. We start in the grasping as many tests as we can.
You bring up so many interesting thought problems and challenges. One of them is, I mean, should we even be thinking about creating machines that have consciousness? Because as soon as we do, say that we do and we're able to test for it, it presents a lot of challenges for society of how to interact with these machines, how to deal with them. In other words, do these machines have rights? And there's all sorts of other problems that has to do if a machine is conscious.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up. I suggest that to the extent that we even detect consciousness in machines, we may, as a society, need to consider the possibility of what I call conscious engineering, or consciousness engineering. So consider going to an Android shop and buying an Android to take care of your home. How would you feel if you were bringing home a sentient being? I mean, wouldn't that be like slavery? You might say, well, what if it's programmed to just want to work for me and do nothing else? But that's freaky.
I mean,
it kind of reminds me of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World,
right,
where there was a whole class of individuals who were genetically engineered to be less intelligent. So I don't think that's what we really want. To the extent that we do want conscious machines, it will probably be for very specific reasons.
Like long-distance space travel and stuff like that.
It could be. So, we do sometimes – I have a group of individuals that I spend a lot of time with at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study. And, you know, one of the projects we have is a project on the possibility of putting sentient AIs in space. Now, that's – I talk about that a little bit in the book, and it is one of the more speculative elements of the book. It's sort of there to be suggestive. I think on Earth, a more realistic scenario could be that someone wants an AI companion that they find they really want to have that felt quality of experience. So we might, in that sense, like people might marry AIs, and it's going to be rather empty to be in a deep relationship with something that has no conscious experience. Right.
I can already see loads of problems here, because if you're going to marry like a zombie, then that's like just a couple of steps up from a sex doll. But
right,
once you put consciousness in it, it has to have the right to also leave you when it feels like the relationship isn't satisfying.
Yeah, exactly. Which all this kind of sounds like how things are with biological humans. And so why would you want an AI? I mean, maybe if you couldn't find anybody else, or you wanted something that could never get ill. I mean, these are the kind of questions we may have to ask.
Well, they're highly moral questions, because you'd be programming a machine to be at least a conceptual slave, in the sense that it would be enslaved to you and nobody else. And that's like the movie She. Her
was great. And, you know, I don't want to give the plot away, but I mean, intriguingly, in that case, the AI became vastly smarter than the human. And, you know, all kinds of interesting plot lines developed based on that.
But she could also she also was able to have experiences he could not have.
And that's exactly right.
And he had to just let her experience the life that she was going to live. And is she living a life? I mean, can you actually use that term? The AI is then living that life. Is that a correct term?
I think you can. I mean, you know, like, for example, the NASA Astrobiology Institute defines life in such a way that artificial life can actually satisfy the definition. So I don't have a problem with using the expression life, but what I would say is let's not anthropomorphize that life form, because not all forms of life are conscious or sentient. I mean, I, for one, don't think the aloe vera plant in front of me is conscious.
Right.
Okay.
But could have some kind of more.
We'll debate that.
There are people who believe like everything has some, even a rock has some kind of experience. But there is a lot of proof that, for instance, among mammals and other animals, not just mammals, but some birds and other species, that there is some kind of consciousness, like, say, a dog, a gorilla, a dolphin. And but it ends up that the consciousness, although we have several points where we can sort of recognize that, their consciousness is going to be very different from ours. And you know, you bring up that idea of living with an AI. Well, that's like living with a dog, where essentially you've enslaved a dog.
Oh, my God, I know. And as I'm being interviewed right now, you guys can probably hear my puppy whimpering in the background because it wants to be on my lap. And there are a lot of responsibilities. I have a big farm. I have like 90 animals. Oh, God, my dog's going to bark right now.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's real.
Yeah, it's real. I mean, it reminds us of the reality of the responsibilities that we would have. And, you know, that's why I kind of wanted to write the book, because I wanted to help people to explore and understand what the future of the mind may be like. It could be that there'll be a plurality of kinds of minds, not just biological ones like, you know, our dogs, but also machine minds. But we better know what we're doing. We better know if we're really creating beings that are minded, or if we're just creating non-conscious machines that act fairly convincingly like it does feel like something to be them. So there's a lot that we need to explore, and to the extent that we can control whether we create something that's conscious or not, if it's highly intelligent, we need to ask in what context it's pragmatically as well as ethically justifiable to do so.
Well, and also there's a worry. If we do create AI life that's conscious, will it be life that values our consciousness?
Yeah. And one thing I suggest in the book is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about AI safety. And, you know, people like Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, Max Tegmark. I mean, a lot of individuals, Stuart Russell and his interesting new book, Human Compatible, mm-hmm. They all worry about the control problem, which is the issue of how, if we build, you know, AIs that outthink us, we could ever control them. And I suggest, well, let's explore consciousness, because it could be that if we make conscious machines, that actually helps with AI safety, because they'll feel a sense of empathy for us, just like I feel a sense of compassion for, you know, the goats in my paddock, because I'm a conscious being and I assume that it feels like something to be them.
However, your relationship with the goats is definitely one of you owning the goats, and therefore you still believe that you're superior, even if you don't consciously believe you're superior, you act like you're superior. And that's what people worry about, is that AI is going to be a lot faster in thought and able to make more connections than we could possibly make. And they're going to look at us like you look at goats. Like, we may be amusing, I hope, but it could present real problems about whether, and you know, that some people believe that that's the next step in evolution anyways. And that's the other whole other part of your book. And that's like transferring human consciousness into a machine, sort of an android-like body, and therefore achieving, you know, the ability to live forever. And you are very cautious about that. You are very cautious about transferring human consciousness into a machine.
Yeah, for sure. And I love what you just said, by the way. And I love the possibility that right now we're in some sort of zoo or playpen for biological beings, and our machine overlords have not made themselves known to us.
I know. There's a possibility that they're already there, and we just don't know.
We're probably in a computer simulation.
I know. But, I mean, there's an interesting thought problem that you have in your book where people have the ability now to replace parts of the human brain with a chip. And then they could essentially replace part of your brain with a chip and then another part and another part. It's a whole process. And therefore, at the end, would that be you in the machine body? And you're very skeptical that that would be you.
Oh, yeah. And I think people who speak as if the future of the mind, like we could survive the death of the brain by uploading, have been drinking way too much Kool-Aid. I talk about all the different problems with the view. I mean, I just can't believe it. Because, see, the thing is, how many of your listeners would feel that there's something plausible to the idea that the mind is just the brain? I bet you people feel that that's a respectable view.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay, all right.
So well, you certainly know that if you damage parts of the brain, you really lose aspects of your conscious
Right. Even if you're religious, you realize that, the brain is essential to your earthly existence. Okay, right. So just bearing that reasonable claim in mind, okay? Now, suppose you walk into a mind design center and you replace parts of your brain with microchips. Well, you might function the way you did before, but would it really be you? You've just scooped out parts of your biological brain, right? At some point, you're no longer going to exist. So as you think you're enhancing by adding all these, you know, fancy mental abilities, what you're really doing is killing yourself. and you don't know at what point it happens.
That there is going to be a point as you're doing the transfer where all of a sudden you've lost the sense of who you are. You're a zombie.
You could be. The issues are really interesting because it could be that the being that replaces you is conscious. If we can get microchips that can underlie conscious experience, then it could be a conscious being.
But it wouldn't be you that's in your body now.
Yeah, you would have replaced yourself with a sort of artificial intelligence that functioned in ways that you did originally, but has all these funky enhancements. So you killed yourself and you just didn't realize it. And you paid money to do it.
Doctor, we have like minutes left. Define transhumanism.
Oh, yeah. Well, transhumanists are people who generally hold these kinds of views that I've been attacking, the view that you could upload.
But you're a transhumanist yourself.
Yeah, I am. Or I was. I mean, see, the thing is that if you look at the Transhumanist Declaration, which I actually published in the appendix.
That's right. That's in the back of your book.
Yeah, because I want to make sure that people understand the strengths and weaknesses of the position. So the transhumanists generally say that technology should free us. And, we should do as much as we can to extend the lifespan and even enhance our ability to think and reach a sort of technotopia. And I find these ideas really important and interesting. And I think a lot of people are transhumanists these days. But what I like to do as a philosopher is show that some of the more commonplace transhumanist views are actually incorrect. So, the idea that people like Elon Musk and Ray Kurzweil and Michio Kaku have of, transferring your mental functions to, microchips and eventually maybe even uploading, that's Kurzweil's idea, sort of technotopia. Sadly, that's not something that would be a way for you to survive.
We're completely out of time.
I know.
We could talk about, first of all, there are so many ideas that you raise in questions and concepts in this book, which is the real value of it, because people need to be asking these questions now before sort of the horse has left the barn. My guest tonight has been Dr. Susan Schneider. She's the NASA Baruch Bloomberg Chair at the Library of Congress and the director of the AI Mind and Society Group at the University of Connecticut. And we've been talking about her book, and it's going to sound like it's really sort of science fiction. It's not. And it's questions we need to ask now. Artificial you, AI, and the future of your mind. Doctor, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.